You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're on the chapter, True North and Other Virtues. True North, trust, and the like. These are the mission impossible? Not totally, of course. In their seminal book, Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies, James Collins and Jerry Porras point out that great CEOs are less concerned with strategies, business models, particular products, or immediate financial payoffs than building great institutions that serve all their constituencies over long periods of time. They cite CEOs like George Merrick II, who in 1950 defined True North for a company that bore his name when he said, quote, "We try to remember that medicine is for the patient. It is not for the profits. The profits follow, and if we've remembered that, they will never fail to appear. The better we have remembered it, the larger we have been." I have a comment to make about this off the book right now, that Steve Jobs and Apple always focused on the customer and the product, making the product meet or exceed the expectations of the customer. And sure enough, the profits followed. Apple has run into trouble in recent years because it's focused increasingly on shareholder return and not on the product or the customer as much as they used to, and they've suffered tremendously because of that. Back to the book. Another of their examples is David Packard, co-founder of Hewlett Packard, whom the quote is saying is, quote, "I think many people assume wrongly that a company exists simply to make money. While this is an important result of a company's existence, we have to go deeper and find the real reasons for our being. Our main task is to design, develop, and manufacture the finest electronic equipment for the advancement of science and for the welfare of humanity." The authors make it clear, however, that Packard believed in profits as well, for they were what allowed the company to pursue its broader goals in the future. Anyone who cannot accept profit as one of the most important objectives of this company has no place either now or in the future of the management team of this company, Packard is quoted as saying. In the context of the new economy, roller coaster that it is, these leaders are hard acts for today's CEOs to follow. Chapter 5. A vision without execution is an hallucination. A comment I have to make on this is from Anthony Robbins, who also said that a vision without execution is a complete waste of time. So this chapter focuses on the importance of execution. In the midst of an industrial revolution, all of a company's constituencies crave a simple but compelling picture of where in the world the company is going. Such demands force business leaders to create a powerful vision and a set of attainable goals. But executing that vision is more important than ever, too. And the same factors that cloud a clear view of the next several years make implementing plans increasingly difficult. Not only does the underlying terrain, the technology, the people, and the competition keep shifting, but the penalty for missing targets, the price exacted by Wall Street in terms of lost market value, and the damage to a company's reputation from newspaper stories about failed goals is getting higher. In the recent past, there have been a number of times when either vision or execution, but not both, were of extreme importance. In the 1950s and 1960s, for example, business leaders in the United States could promote a social vision of mass consumption. For example, two cars for every family, say, without too much concern for quality. However, in the next two decades, due in large part to competition from Japan, execution was at a premium, and many Americans deserted Detroit's products. Today, consumers want to see the aspiration and the reality. The vision needs to be powerful, and it needs to be credible. The execution needs to be nearly flawless. We can ask, what exactly is this vision? It is not a mission statement describing a company's objectives. It is not the kind of slick, cliché-ridden corporate letter that often appears in annual reports. A vision needs to be an imaginative picture of where a company will be and why that positioning will be a transforming event, not just for the company, but for its customers and other constituencies. A vision needs to be sufficiently broad and deep to ride the specific transactions, such as plans for a merger or sale of a division. When I hear CEOs explain where they want to take their companies, there is an element of personal passion, almost as if a leader and the vision were one, and the vision existed in the form it did because of the personality and character of that particular CEO. Chief executives will also give you a brutally frank assessment of the obstacles to the effective implementation of their vision. They talk passionately about the strategy that needs to be put in place, the speed of decision-making that is required, the awesome challenges of communicating with all of their constituencies, and the gambles that they have to be taken. In short, the complexity and risks of putting all the pieces together in a fast-moving situation. What emerges from the vision execution conundrum is a classic catch-22. In an era of heightened competition, the vision had better be spectacular. But the more spectacular the vision, the more difficult it is to execute properly. I caught Stephen Case, chairman and CEO of AOL, in his Dulles, Virginia headquarters a few months before he announced his intention to merge with Time Warner. He walked into the conference room wearing a Hawaiian shirt and khakis, a small backpack over his shoulder, and a can of Coca-Cola in his hand. In our talk, he painted a strikingly clear and highly ambitious view of where he wanted his company to go and what he wanted it to be. Throughout his career, he said, he had held one idea out front: to build a global medium as central to people's lives as the telephone or television, and even more valuable. In its simplicity and grandeur, this is reminiscent of Henry Ford's goal to build a great car that no man making a good salary would be unable to own and enjoy with his family, enjoying the blessing of hours of pleasure in God's open spaces. Case described three phases in the evolution of his company. First was to build an online service. Then, starting in the mid-1990s, He worked on developing a structure for the business so that it would grow in an organized way. Now, he said, our attention is on creating a great medium and making sure that it had a positive impact on the economy and on society. Case discussed several elements of his game plan. He wanted to double the number of subscribers by the year 2005, with a heavy emphasis not just on the United States, but also abroad, to develop services that will encourage users to triple their time online with AOL companies, keeping them for about 3 hours per day, and to deliver services not just via computers, but also via televisions, cell phones, and other devices that might be embedded into cars or kitchens in the future. In the process, he wanted AOL to overtake most of the 24 companies rated above it in market value on the Wall Street Journal's list of the country's largest firms. Case wants to use sophisticated technologies combined with simple delivery and ease of use. Quote, I think one of the things that served this company well over the past 15 years was that if we weren't wedded to any prior culture, he said, if we had grown up in Silicon Valley, we probably would have looked at the world through the prism of technology. If we had been born in Hollywood, the prism would have been entertainment. If we had started in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, where AT&T happens to be headquartered, we would have seen ourselves as a communication company. It is not possible for most companies to put aside decades or sometimes a century of traditions and lessons learned and not apply it to the future. Sometimes that is helpful because you avoid making the same mistakes over and over again. But most of the time it's harmful because you end up assuming that the future is going to look quite a bit like the past, which in the case of many industries usually isn't so. AOL grew up in Northern Virginia, where there was really no culture, just a sleepy government town with lots of government contractors. We started from scratch, no obvious talent pool, no venture capitalists. But in retrospect, it was very helpful in those formative years because we looked at this medium through the prism of consumers as opposed to bringing any other baggage to it. One of Case's most important goals is to establish a brand that consumers can trust. Quote, we will continue to innovate, of course, he said, but we'll do it in stages so that every time you sign on, we don't force you to download a new browser, for example. We know people who want innovation. We also know that they don't want the screens to look different every day. He returns to the same concepts many times in the interview. Choice, convenience, flexibility, immediacy, interactivity, personalization. These are all the words that he wishes that people will associate with his online AOL. Case believes strongly in a broader relationship between AOL and the population at large. He is among the most vocal and articulate CEOs, pointing out the need for careful responses to issues like privacy and the taxation of e-commerce. He has argued for stepped-up industry self-regulation and an overhaul of outmodeled government regulation, which he said fails to take into account the blurring of communication technologies. Taken together, Case's vision is unambiguous. Enhancing customers' lives wherever the internet is, setting enormously ambitious qualitative business goals, and leading society in the internet world. Several months after I met with Case, he announced the proposed merger between AOL and Time Warner. There was no end to speculation and commentary in the press and Wall Street as the motivations behind the deal. They asked, was Case after content to enhance AOL's penetration into the lives of his customers? Did he anticipate the end of the boom for pure internet companies and want to grab on to an old economy organization, tangible assets? There were other questions as well. Did Case air badly by making AOL out pure of the pure internet world? Would it be possible to combine the cultures of AOL and Time Warner? Or would this merger fail as so many others had? At this point, only time will tell. But it did strike me that Case's strategy was consistent with everything he had told me. The burning desire to build the greatest communications medium ever devised required a big step. And access to enormous content that would compel consumers to use it. Time Warner brought not just news, but also movies and TV programs. AOL was looking for ways to link to other people's homes. And Time Warner brought broadband cable connections. The combined operation catered also to another of Case's visions, to use his company to shape the new world of communications, and for that he needed even more scale than he had before the merger, because the playing field was brutally competitive, and it was also global. And consider what Case did not do with his deal. He did not make AOL fancier from the technological standpoint, at least as far as customers were concerned. He did not change the qualities he saw as essential to success, particularly easy accessibility. He just gave us more reasons to log on and tune in, and he opened up a range of possibilities that even now no one can fully foresee. Vision is not limited to companies associated with the new economy. Take Ford Motor Company, one of the world's oldest manufacturing companies. The most profitable car maker in 1999 was the one posed to overtake General Motors as the automotive corporation with the largest global sales. William Clay Ford Jr., the great-grandson of founder Henry Ford, has been a Ford employee since 1979 and the company's chairman since 1998. Like Stephen Case, Ford wants to create a revolution. An enthusiastic environmentalist and a prospective black belt in Taekwondo, he bears the responsibility, just as Christopher Galvin does, of shepherding a family dynasty through a brand new era. It is hard not to sense the sweep of American industrial history when you take the elevator to the executive suites. Hard not to be impressed by the optimism, sincerity, and openness of the 41-year-old chairman in whose hands this corporate giant now largely rests.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC. But it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're at the chapter, A Vision Without Execution is an Hallucination. We're looking right now at the Ford Motor Company. Chairman Ford described where he wants his company to be. Quote, "We are standing on the thresholds of two revolutions in an industry that hasn't had a real revolution in almost 100 years, he said. "One is driven by the internet, and we will transform the way we deal with our customers with information and products. The other relates to how we power our vehicles. We're redefining what it means to be an industrial company." He discussed two changes that will characterize the company in the future. "Most of our business will be touched by the internet, and indeed it already has. Our president, Jacques Nassar, says that if you go back to even a very short while ago, our whole idea of a customer was that we would wholesale a car to a dealer. The dealer would then sell the car to the customer, and we hoped we would never hear from that customer again, because if we did, it meant that something was wrong. Today we wish to establish a dialogue, an ongoing dialogue, with the customer throughout the entire ownership experience. That is why Ford is getting into all aspects of the auto-owning experience, from the initial inspections of available automobiles, organization of financing, to parts and service, and ultimately to recycling of old cars into reusable metal." Quote, "We want to talk to and touch our customers every step of the way," he says. "We want to be a consumer products and services company that just happens to be in the automotive business. The internet is the key to all of this." The second part of the transformation of one of the country's oldest global companies revolves around clean fuel and the environment. Quote, "When it comes to fuel sources, we hope to lead a clean revolution," Ford told me. Quote, "The company has certified all of its plants around the world under the toughest environmental standards, something I do not believe anyone else in the industry has done," he said. "We're aiming for a dramatic shift in the role of the internal combustion engine. And we have committed to have cars on the road for sale in 2004 running on fuel cells. This means that the only thing that comes out of the tailpipe is water vapor." William Ford is making a big bet that putting his company on the right side of the environmental issues will pay off in the long run. Quote, "At the end of the century, many of the great ideological issues are off the table," he explained. "It is now a question of what consumers are going to be demanding rather than what business leaders are envisioning. Consumers want a safer, cleaner, more equitable world, and they'll buy from companies that display these characteristics. I believe that companies are responsible to these needs, and they're responding to them as well, assuming they have great products and services, of course. And if so, they will have a commanding market position. I stake much of my personal reputation on the environment," William Ford told me. "I wake up sometimes wondering whether I'm the only one who feels this way, and whether I'm taking the company on a diversionary course that in the end won't pay off. But on other nights I wake up thinking that we're not doing enough. Fact is, I see the company that gets this issue right has a chance to really put some distance between themselves, reputationally, and all the rest of the pack." Ford is trying to position his company to embrace several powerful trends in society. These trends include high technology, web-centric management, manufacturing, intense consumer focus, and social responsibility as reflected in environmental consciousness. Together, they constitute a new brand for the Old Line Manufacturing Company. "We are trying to build up a lot of trust," he said. "Trust that our product is good, trust that we will treat customers very well, and trust that we will stand for something that our customers and employees can be proud of." In the months since my interview, the Ford Motor Company has faced several problems that have threatened the credibility of William Ford's ambitious goals. The first of these came in May 2000 when the company released its first corporate citizen report, an unsparing public assessment of the dilemmas it faced as a company. Quote, Ford's activities have significant impacts on all aspects of society, it said. However, SUVs, or sport utility vehicles, raise issues relative to Ford's corporate citizenship commitment. The report went on to explain that these vehicles can cause serious safety and environmental problems. Yet the company said it would keep building SUVs, which according to one analyst generated $18,000 profit per vehicle. Ford's president and CEO, Jacques Nassar, said that although customers wanted environmentally friendly vehicles, they were unwilling to pay more for them or do without many of the current features of the SUVs. The citizenship report promised that Ford would continue to improve the fuel economy of all of its vehicles, as well as to find ways to reduce the damage that SUVs caused and accidents to lower riding vehicles. At a press conference, Ford admitted that Wall Street does not reward progressive and environmentally friendly companies, but that he continues to have environmental payoffs as an objective. 5, 10, 20, 50 years down the line, he admits. 2 months later, Jacques Nasser committed the company to increasing the average fuel efficiency of its sport utility vehicle by 25% over the next 5 years by adjusting engines and making auto parts lighter. The increase was the first fundamental change in fuel economy in any major passenger car category in almost two decades. According to press reports, Ford officials were hoping that their pro-environmental policies would give all their brands an image of responsibility. The New York Times editorialized, quote, environmentalists on the whole were delighted. They noted that if Ford can build SUVs that yield better mileage per gallon, other companies are sure to follow. And if they do, William Ford will further solidify his reputation as the most adventurous executive in an industry not previously known for environmental stewardship. 3 months later, the company was hit by a much bigger thunderbolt. The forced recall of over 6 million Firestone tires that had been mounted on Ford Explorers and linked, as of mid-December, to at least 88 deaths. In congressional hearings that month, everything William Ford was trying to do was challenged. At that point, did Ford Motor Company know that the tires were defective? To what degree were these deaths attributable to defects in the vehicles as opposed to defects in the tires? The crisis was in its early stages when this book was put to bed, but at a bare minimum, it constituted a body blow to where William Ford's vision of a new and more trusting relationship between the Ford Motor Company and its customers. But this was not the first large-scale crisis that unfolded for people around the world to see, in which great business leaders helped their companies to regain their reputation. In 1982, Johnson & Johnson recovered from the Tylenol scare, in large part because of the skilled actions of CEO James E. Burke. In 1997, Texaco was able to handle serious problems of racial prejudice with the help of Chairman and CEO Peter I. Bijoux, who left no stone unturned in an effort to rectify the situation. The big question, therefore, is whether William Ford's vision is strong enough and he and his team good enough to guide the company back to where Ford wants to be. We will continue this analysis of this book in further shows, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.